by God. And so here, what's that? No, no. As long as there's no yellow Volkswagens.
Then
it'll distract me. I'll be thinking, okay, wait a minute. Should I trust my senses or not? What is meant by God? I just put a little minute and a half. In fact, Donald Williams was the one who put it on Facebook, posted it, and I just shared it on my Facebook page. A little 1.5 minute talk by Francis Schaeffer, an excerpt from one of his talks. About, he says that God is the most meaningless term right now. When people say, I believe in God, Schaeffer said, and this is, Schaeffer died in 1984, and this is probably the late 70s when he gave the talk. And he said, when people say they believe in God, I tell them, okay, keep talking. And because you haven't told me anything. So what is meant by God? Here we're dealing with worldviews, and we'll talk about theism. Theism, pantheism, panentheism. Finite godism, I just like calling it finite theism, limited god. And there's different versions of it. So you got dualism, polytheism. Henotheism. Then, of course, you have atheism, agnosticism, and skepticism. And so we'll put those up here. Atheism, agnosticism, skepticism. Okay, atheism, okay, is the belief there is no God. And there are no no leading thinkers, no leading atheist thinkers alive today. And now, if Richard Dawkins was here, he'd start throwing a tantrum, and or whatever. But he's not an atheist. Agnosticism means no, gnosis, no knowledge, means no knowledge of God. Now, there's soft agnostics and hard agnostics. The soft agnostic says, I have no knowledge of God because I haven't seen enough evidence to believe in him, but there might be enough evidence there. So that's the guy who doesn't believe in God, but he's willing to talk to you, and he says things like, wow, that's interesting, I never thought about that. Maybe I got to give this God issue a little bit more thought. That's a soft agnostic. So we don't really have to, you know, there's no real major threat from them. Those guys are open. The hard agnostic says, I have no knowledge of God because the evidence is so insufficient. Any thinking person would say, look, if God exists, we'll never know. There's just no way to prove God's existence. That's...
Norbert Geisler put that there's ordinary agnostic. And then there's
honoring. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Honoring?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the second
hard,
ordinary and honoring.
And so Richard Dawkins is actually a hard agnostic. Yeah. Michael Martin was a hard agnostic. When I debated him in 1997, he's, you know, so basically the belief that there is definitely no God, that's dead, okay? There is
all the major like the four horsemen of the
they're hard agnostics.
They're
yeah
hard agnostics.
Yeah, now you could be an atheist and believe God certainly does not exist. They might even be atheists really behind closed doors, but they're never going to debate that way. So even Dawkins says it's always possible that God exists. So but what they did was in the 1990s, Michael Martin's book Atheism: A Philosophical Justification, redefined atheism, rather than being no God, as lack of belief in God, which then meant I don't have to prove anything. I have no belief to defend. I just lack belief in God. So the burden of proof is totally on the Christian or the theist. You have something to defend. I can just sit back and throw rocks at your worldview. Okay? In that same book, Michael Martin admits he has, there's no agreed upon epistemology. No agreed upon theory of knowledge among atheist philosophers. Well, that's because if there's no God, there is no defense of why we would know anything. But in reality, lack of belief in God is really agnosticism. See, when atheism died was with Big Bang cosmology. Once, you know, because Friedrich Nietzsche type atheist said, look, the universe doesn't need a cause because it's always existed. So the traditional atheist understood from nothing, nothing comes, but the universe has always been here. But with Big Bang cosmology in the 1920s, 20 years after Nietzsche died, we began to realize the universe is expanding in all different directions as we move forward in time. So if you go backwards, the universe will get more and more compact until you reach a point of infinite density or a point where the universe takes up no dimensions in space. In other words, you reach a point where there was no universe. And then, boom, it exploded into existence. So now that science acknowledges, embraces the beginning of the universe, very few atheists exist. And to say that you're going to prove... Think about it. If you're going to prove atheism is true with absolute certainty, you would have to be God. You'd have to be omnipresent. You'd have to be all-knowing. You'd have to be God to have access to enough information to know that God doesn't exist. So it's self-refuting, okay? Now, I would also say hard agnosticism is also self-refuting, because to say that man cannot know God, that's what hard agnosticism is. Man cannot know God. Man cannot know anything about God. Well, in order to know that man cannot know anything about God, you'd have to know something about God in the first place. So these are all self-refuting positions. In reality, if you really wanted to be, you'd be a soft agnostic. Say, well, I just don't know, and I'm willing to listen to you. I've done a lot of reading on it, and I'm just not convinced. But, you know, more power to you. That's the way you would respond, not the Richard Dawkins saying that you're a bright if you don't believe in God, but if you do believe in God, you're pretty much an ignoramus. And then he gets blown away in his debates. Skepticism, you suspend judgment on God's existence. So... you say, well, I'm skeptical about it, so it's kind of like, I doubt that God exists. But just keep in mind that atheism is dead. It was refuted. It died. But what they did was, through sleight of hand, they redefined it. So in 1948, when Bertrand Russell, the leading quote-unquote atheist, debated Frederick Copleston, during that debate, Copleston said, what is you? Well, what are you? What is your worldview? And Bertrand Russell was smart enough to acknowledge. He said, I'm an agnostic. I'm not an atheist. I'm an agnostic. 40 years later, by the time of Michael Martin, now atheists are, they've... redefined agnosticism. I mean, they redefined atheism in such a way that lacking belief in God is now atheism. And it's not in, even the Greek words, you know, no, theos, no God. It never meant no knowledge of God. So, you know, and by the way, Christians do the same thing. People who claim to be Christian, every time the worldview changes or something in our culture or the laws change, you just change Christianity with it. And but in reality, atheism is dead. And now it's hard agnosticism that we're dealing with. Okay, theism. When we say theism, we almost always mean monotheism, one God. Okay? And so that's the belief in one personal infinite God. If God has limitations, then it's finite theism. One limited God. In fact, let's get rid of the capital G. Okay, one personal infinite God. God is both immanent and transcendent. Immanent, God is involved with the universe. He can intervene. He can perform miracles. Transcendent, he's separate from the creation. So we'll just say one personal infinite God who can perform miracles. Okay? At least has the ability to perform miracles. So that's theism. We Christians, we're not tritheist, that would be belief in three gods, but we're Trinitarian theist, Trinitarian monotheist. We believe in one God, but we believe that one God is three persons. Deism, like Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin, you get the one God, again, personal and all, who either cannot or does not perform miracles. Okay? And so you get a God who creates the universe and then leaves it alone. Just sets things in motion. And so they began to view miracles, used our reason to say, well, miracles are violations of the laws of nature. Laws of nature dictate what can and cannot happen. Miracles violate the laws of nature. Violations of the laws of nature are impossible. Therefore, no miracles are possible. Well, problem with that is you're defining miracles out of existence. What if miracles are not violations of the laws of nature? What if they just supersede the laws of nature? Also, what we found is science no longer... Most of these hard agnostics are dinosaurs because scientists no longer consider the laws of nature as prescriptive, prescribing what can and cannot occur. They're now viewed as descriptive. They're the way we humans describe the way, you know, the laws of nature describe the way things generally occur. They do not prescribe the way things have to occur. Okay? See, and Richard, what does Richard Dawkins say? Richard Dawkins said, well, see, the apostles were pre-scientific. They didn't have all this knowledge of scientific laws, so that's why they believed in the resurrection. Okay, think about that for a minute. If the apostles were as stupid as Richard Dawkins thinks they were, so they didn't know that dead bodies are supposed to stay dead, then why in the world would they worship Jesus when he rose from the dead? When Jesus rose from the dead and appeared to them, they would have thought, oh, yeah, this is normal. This kind of thing happens all the time. Let's go back to whatever it was we were doing. But when they saw him risen from the dead, the reason why they worshipped him was they understood this is a miracle. Dead bodies are supposed to stay dead. So you wouldn't recognize a miracle if you were so pre-scientific that you didn't understand the general way that nature runs. But these guys believed... Now, the founding fathers, Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, were pro-Christian deist. They didn't believe God could perform miracles, but they did believe that God could use the laws of nature, and through divine providence, he could answer our prayers. So they believed it was worthwhile praying. They also thought Christianity was good for America, because if people really believe the Bible's the Word of God, which Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin did not believe the Bible was the inspired Word of God, but if the masses believed it, it'd be a lot easier. They would obey it even when the government's not looking. Now, not everybody's as intellectual and as brilliant as Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin, but because they thought they were so brilliant, they were able to be like sexually immoral, and they could handle stepping outside of biblical morality, but it's a good thing that the masses embrace it. So there was a little bit of elitism and all, but it was pro-Christian. French deism was an anti-Christian deism, and first thing they did was, when they came to power, was, you know, send the clergy to the guillotines and bulldoze the churches. So French deism, you worshipped reason, whereas the founding fathers that were deist were pro-Christian deist, and they believed the Bible was a human book, but it was the highest level of human wisdom that human wisdom had attained in reference to government and morality. So let's build our government on this. So now today's deist in American politics tend to be Jacobin, cold-blooded French deist, anti-Christian deist. And believe me, if you don't believe in the God of the Bible, once you come to power, if you can get away with it, you will, you know, slaughter your enemy. I mean, right now, the liberals, they want more and more illegal immigrants, and they want to get them the right to vote, and they don't want you to be able to check their driver's license, their picture IDs when they vote. That's the way they're winning elections. But if they had complete power, then you could just, anybody who you know is not going to vote for your party, you could just eliminate them, imprison them. If it costs too much to take care of them, just get rid of them.
And there's a new idea of the 20th century branch of deism that I never really talked about. They call it the concept of an alien god. I know H.P. Lovecraft's fiction kind of introduced it, but the idea that if there's a creator God, he's not an architect. We have no conception and reason. We cannot logically imagine this God, so we would call it madness. But I wondered if you had heard anything about that.
No, I know Robert Price, the guy that I dialogued with, who doesn't believe Jesus existed, loves that guy's work and writes a lot of articles on it. So by alien God, you mean just a totally different God?
Something so outside of our tiny, what's known as our tiny island of logic and reason, that experiencing this God would drive us insane.
Okay.
Or we couldn't possibly perceive it because of that.
Yeah.
Kind of self-defeating, because then what's the point of debating it?
Yeah, and how would you even know that? But whatever the case, I'm trying to, and so he wouldn't even deal with whether it's an infinite God or a finite God. Do you know?
Yeah, he wouldn't. He would just say.
Okay. Yeah. So that's kind of an agnosticism that embraces, but he does believe this God exists.
More or less.
Okay. So it's probably just more of an agnosticism where if God exists, he's so outside of our bounds of knowledge, we wouldn't even be able to experience him. By the way, a lot of agnostics would say that, that the finite cannot know the infinite. So a lot of agnostics would say that, and it sounds like he's kind of putting all his chips in there. I would say the finite cannot know the infinite unless the infinite chooses to reveal himself in ways finite creatures could understand. So it's a little bit more complicated than the finite cannot know the infinite. The finite cannot know the infinite unless the infinite chooses to reveal himself in ways finite creatures could understand. That's exactly what the Bible teaches. Yeah. All even what we know by reason is because of God's natural revelation, God revealing truth to us through nature, and then God also reveals truth through us supernaturally. And this is where even Thomas Aquinas is like, tracks this better than any theologian in the history of Christianity, where he says that even the truths that we know about God, we don't exhaustively know God, and we don't know everything. God knows everything, and he exhaustively knows himself. But even the truths that we do know that God knows, God infinitely knows those truths. We only finitely know those truths. So even the truths that we know about God, we see in the glass dimly, like Paul says. So it's kind of like if we had a perfect painting of God, it's all blurry, our view of it, you know? Yeah, yeah.
I take care of the library at my church, and I'm wondering, I have...
What church is it?
I've discovered something disturbing in the children's books that I went through, and it shocked me, and at one point I decided to go ahead and look through some other children's books. And I threw several of them out because they did not include resurrection or the ascension of Christ in children's books. What is that about?
Now, let me ask you this. Were the books intended just to show, like, was it like just like the... Is it supposed to be the whole biblical story, or is it supposed to be just an excerpt of it?
Because biblical story of Christ.
It's supposed to be like the whole life of Christ, and they never get to... Yeah, you know, it's not We Wisdom or anything like that. So it's not.
It's more for upper grade school.
Wow.
Okay.
Next time, if you find another one like that, bring it over to me. Yeah, I don't know. Some children's book you might want to look into. I think they're on Amazon.com. He goes to CreateSpace. William Lane Craig co-authors a lot of children's books, and so. He teaches philosophy to little kids through some of his books. So, it might be written by deists who believe Jesus. The Thomas Jefferson Bible, he cut out all the miracles. It was really crazy, too. He didn't really cut out the miracles so much because he was opposed to miracles, which he was. But mainly he just thought, man... The Gospels are just so fantastic. They got these miracles in them. If they would just focus on... So it's kind of his love for Jesus' teachings that caused him to cut out the miracles, not his denial of miracles, even though he did deny the miracles. So in other words, he was not trying to convince Christians that Jesus didn't perform miracles. He wanted to promote the teachings of Christ, but miracles were beneath him. Or so he thought. But the Thomas Jefferson Bible is just the Gospels without any miracles. But they had the resurrection?
Yeah.
I would think that they're probably then solid biblical Christians, and then they just didn't place the importance on the ascension that should be there. But if they've got him bodily rising from the dead and appearing alive?
What does that mean for the child of sin? God, Jesus is still here on the planet?
Mm-hmm. It would be kind of odd to not include that, but yeah, I don't know.
That's what became very disturbing.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to see those books. Yeah. Kate, now pantheism, pan means everything. Theos is God, so everything is God, so it's God is the universe. And God is a non-personal force. Okay, so that's pantheism. So really, only one being exists. It's monism. Only one being exists, but this one being is God, so it's pantheism. All pantheists are monists, but not all monists are pantheists. Some monists say all reality is one being, but the one being is not God. Now, by the way, it's impossible to share pantheism in a consistent manner, because then it would be one mind trying to convince another mind that only one mind exists. Okay? So that's self-refuting. Also, pantheists usually say the physical world is less than fully real. It's Maya. It's an illusion. So like the Hindu pantheist will say that the physical realm is less than real, so physical bodies don't really exist. And individual souls don't exist. There's really only, that's part of the illusion, there's only one world soul, God. But they teach reincarnation, which necessitates, reincarnation is not an illusion. It's not taught as an illusion. But reincarnation necessitates the existence of individual souls that are reincarnated in physical bodies. And Hinduism doesn't give you either one of those. So a lot of problems with pantheism. Also, no such thing as right and wrong, because God is one. He's beyond all dualities. So everything is one. So good is evil, evil is good. That's why Lucas, when he tried to promote Eastern pantheistic thought, and he's got a dark side of the force and a light side of the force, but it's all part of the same force. So it's not the Lord be with you, it's the force be with you. God is a non-personal force. Yet, the reason why he had so much success with the Star Wars movies was because you really did feel like the dark side of the force really was evil, and the light side of the force really was good. So it was this cosmic battle between good and evil. In other words, the only thing that rescued the Star Wars movies and made them exciting was the fact that it borrowed capital from the Christian worldview. Okay? If they really presented it as, well, Darth Vader really isn't bad, and Luke Skywalker isn't really good, and it's okay. There's nothing wrong with using the dark side of the Force. That's just up to you. I mean, if they presented it that way, you'd have a boring one movie, let alone six or however many they've made. Panentheism, everything in God. And so, basically, simple way of saying it, universe is God's body, or you could say God is the soul of the universe. Basically, God is both infinite and finite in his basic nature. God is both infinite and finite in his basic nature. Both unlimited and limited. That's a contradiction. By the way, these guys are called like open theists, borrow a lot from panentheism. And and so you've got a changing God, okay? And these guys believe you can't really be personal unless you change. Your relationship's got to be give and take. So we got to be able to change God to a certain degree. But it's a contradiction to say that God is both infinite and finite in his basic nature, okay? Because if God's finite in his basic nature, then he can't be infinite. If he's infinite in his basic nature, he can't be finite. Now, God the Son became a man. So Jesus is both infinite and finite. How is that not a contradiction? If panentheism is a contradiction because they say that God is both infinite and finite in his basic nature, how is it not a contradiction for Jesus to be both infinite and finite?
Well, panentheism, there's one nature. So within that one nature, there can't be infinite and finite. So within that one nature, that's the key. With theism, with the Trinity, you have an opportunity. You have God, the God Father, one nature. But in a specific time, he took on, well, the Jesus, the second part of the Trinity, also had one nature until a specific point of time where he took upon his human nature.
In the hypostatic union, Jesus is so God, the second person of the Trinity, who had an infinite divine nature without ceasing to have his infinite divine nature, added a human nature. And so the hypostatic union, the way very philosophically minded church fathers, the way they defined it, is that Jesus is one person with two distinct natures forever. So he always existed as God, the second person of the Trinity, but at a point in time, without subtracting from his divine nature, he added a human nature. So if we say Jesus is finite, that's true if we're talking about his human nature. If we say Jesus is infinite, that's true if we're talking about his divine nature. A contradiction means that A cannot equal non-A at the same time in the same way. We're saying that Jesus is both infinite and finite at the same time, but in a different way. In one sense, he's infinite, that's his divine nature. In another sense, he's finite, that's his human nature. Okay?
Panentheism and pantheism have another problem, is that if you consider yourself to be part of God, or a part of his body, in any way, shape, or form, then you don't really actually have any reason to worship the God or have any sort of religious practice whatsoever. And even then, it's like the logical extent of extreme Calvinism. Either it's panentheism, with this God just kind of guiding a dollhouse, or humans are objects with being a semblance or an illusion of will, or we are God. And either way, that precludes the necessity of religious practice. People still meditate, they still go to their temple.
Yeah, well, the thing is, too, is see, with Hinduism and Eastern meditation, the goal is not to try to worship God. If they worship, they worship a manifestation of God. But the goal is not to worship God. The goal is to get past the illusion. And so the goal is more a Gnostic knowledge of trying to get in touch with your own deity and find that you are God. And that's warped, but really, to be technical, when we talk about Hindus worshiping, they're either giving reverence to... See, now, by the way, a lot of Hindus are not pantheist. They're polytheist because they're confused. And they mistake the manifestations of God with God. But the good Hindu theologians would basically say if there is worship in Hinduism, it's worship of the self. But with panentheism, it's really crazy, but I agree with you. As a philosophically minded individual, I agree with you that panentheism makes our relationship with God less personal. Yet the reason why quote unquote Christians embrace open theism or panentheism is an attempt to make God more personal.
And
I agree. The late Marcus Borger, the GS Seminar, is a panentheist, and to me, but for these guys, you cannot have a personal relationship with God unless he's changing. And if there's no changing aspect to God, they just don't think you can't relate to a God who does not change. And so the panentheists, they will reinterpret scriptures that say God cannot change. They say that's figurative language, that's symbolic. And then the passages where it says that God was sorry that he made man and stuff, then they'll say, well, those are to be taken literally. So they do a complete 180 from the way the church is interpreting the scriptures for the last 2,000 years. So now, finite deism, you have one limited God. Usually they have God is limited by evil, like Rabbi Harold Kushner. When his son died in a car accident, he could no longer believe that God allowed that to happen. So he believed that God is battling evil, that God makes mistakes. That's why some people have disabilities, Rabbi Kushner reasoned, and that we need to help forgive God for his mistakes and help God to fight evil, because without our help he might lose. Well, Rabbi Harold Kushner's God is not worthy of worship. Okay? I feel bad about his son dying in a car accident, but the fact of the matter is that's not the God of the Bible. Now, when I went to the Christian bookstore and I saw this nice softbound book for $1.99 and about 25 books on sale for $1.99, about 25 copies of When Bad Things Happen to Good People by Rabbi Harold Kushner, and I see baby Christians walking into the Christian bookstore who are hurting, that's one of the first books they'd buy, I showed them where he says we need to forgive God, God makes mistakes, God might lose the battle to evil, we got to help God. And I told them, you need to either take these books off the shelf, or I'll pay for it, I'll buy a stamp that this book contains heretical material, this is not traditional Christian thought. And a lot of managers at Christian bookstores are not, this is like 20 years ago, but a lot of managers at Christian bookstores are not good theologians. And they thought I was some fly-by-night guy. And so I said, you going to order any more of these? They said, no, we're just selling the ones we got. And I bought all 25 of them and only handed them out to like philosophy students
to refute it.
Yeah. And they also had John Hicks, the center of Christianity, where he says right in the back cover of the book that you can have a vibrant Christian faith and not believe Jesus is God.
Wow.
And that Jesus' deity is a myth. He edited the book, The Myth of God Incarnate. That was a hardbound book, and they were selling it for only a couple bucks. So I had to buy, they only had about four or five of those, though.
So, I don't know that this is, I'm going to say it properly, but the big difference between deism and finite deism is the question of evil. That's why.
Well, they're going to have God either limited in power or knowledge. He's going to be limited in some way. Deism, you got an unlimited God, but he either chooses not to perform miracles or he cannot perform miracles, because they kind of see, the deists started figuring out why earthquakes happen, why thunderstorms happen, how the universe is intelligently designed. And so not being traditional enough in their interpretation of the scriptures, they didn't really have a place for the fall of mankind. And without strong belief in the fall of mankind, any problems in the universe would reflect negatively on the Creator. So it's kind of like if a human makes a machine and has to fix it every now and then, has to intervene, it's because the machine wasn't perfect to begin with. They didn't want God to be slammed, so they thought protecting God, he doesn't perform miracles. But number one, God performs miracles not only to repair that which is broken, but to also reveal himself in a special way to us. And it does not reflect negatively on God, especially since this is a fallen creation. And
if you cannot perform miracles, aren't you limited?
They wouldn't see it as that. They would see if God did perform miracles, that would be a limitation. So now some deists say God cannot perform miracles. Others would say God just chooses not to. But either way, the most deists would say if God performs miracles, that means he's got to clean up a mess that he made. And God doesn't make messes. So Benedict Spinoza, who denied miracles and argued miracles are impossible, he argued that God created this is the best possible world. Christians shouldn't argue this is the best possible world, but this is the best possible way to achieve the best possible world. The best possible world would be a place of eternal joy where free creatures are eternally in a love relationship with God because they freely chose to be in that love relationship with God. In other words, heaven is the best possible world. And so this is the best possible way to achieve that. But we're not arguing that this is the best possible world while the Holocaust goes on and things of that sort. Dualism, by the way, a God that's limited is not worthy of worship. Okay? If God might lose the battle to evil, well, then maybe we should side with evil. Maybe the Satanists got it right. Dualism, belief in two competing gods. Now, Jehovah's Witnesses believe in two gods. They act like you Christians believe in three gods. No, we don't. We believe in one God who is three persons. But the Jehovah's Witnesses believe in the Almighty God, God the Father, and then His first creation, the Mighty God, God the Son, a lesser God, who then created everything else. It's the revival of the ancient Arian heresy that Jesus is a lesser God. But they believe that there are two gods. The infinite God and the limited God, but they're two gods. But God the Father and God the Son, the Jesus as lesser God, they're not competing. So it's really weird that Jehovah's Witnesses, whether they admit it or not, believe in two gods, but they're not dualists. They're actually polytheists. They're a weird kind of polytheist. Polytheists believe in the existence of many gods. But in order to be a dualist, you've got to have the two gods dueling. They're competing with each other. So that's how you explain evil. There's an all-good God, eternal good God, and an eternal evil God, and they're always in battle. Well, the problem with that is then they limit each other. If they limit each other, if you're limited by something outside of yourself, if they limit each other, okay, they're not unlimited. They're not infinite. And Thomas Aquinas' arguments show the only way to explain the existence of finite existence is to posit the existence of infinite existence. So if you had an evil God and a good God, since they're both, they'd be both finite, the only way to rescue that would be to posit the existence of an infinite God who created them. And then you would say, well, the infinite God couldn't be infinitely good if he created evil. So then you end up realizing, wait a minute, evil isn't eternal. See, the thing is, evil cannot exist without good. Because by definition, evil is a privation of the good, or a lack of the good that should be there. So evil is a corruption or perversion of the good. But good can exist without evil. There was a time, well, in eternity, only the triune God existed. And then after God created, he said it is good. Before Lucifer's fall, before mankind's fall, it was all good. So good can exist without evil, but evil can only exist with good. So the problem of evil, we're going to see, actually backfires into an argument for God, not an argument against God. So dualism, two competing gods to try to explain evil. Polytheism, the belief in many gods. These many gods limit each other. So again, the only way to rescue these views of limited gods, the only way to rescue them would be posit the existence of an infinite, unlimited God who created them, but then they're not gods at all. So a lot of times what people are worshiping as the many gods of polytheism, those are actually angelic beings created by God who then fell and are deceiving, like, for instance, tribal peoples and in some cultures. And then henotheism believes in many gods and one is the supreme deity.
Now I have a question about that.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to Muhammad, before he went to the Caliph and decided to pick out the moon god to make the priority, make them and say, I'm just going to worship, because at the time they were all worshiping, mm-hmm. they were polytheists. But then he looked at it and said, okay, well, the moon god was the supreme over all. Would you have called him? But then, I wouldn't say you'd call him, but were they at the time?
I think if we're going to really refute a belief system, we have to honestly refute what they teach. And
what we perceive them to
be. Yeah, Muhammad had to give a name to the god. He had to take a word from the vocabulary of his people. Now, he did bring over some of the pagan practices, either attributed to Allah, the moon god, or even to other gods. He brought some of those superstitions with him, but Muhammad taught that Allah created the universe. So that's not the moon god. So the fact that he called his god by the moon god's name doesn't mean he equated the god of Islam with the moon god. It's the same thing. The ancient Greeks had two primary words for a god, theos and daimonios, and they would use these words interchangeably. So the early church, which was Jewish, almost arbitrarily just decided, well, we'll use this term to mean the false gods. And so the false gods are fallen angels, and we'll call them demons. And we'll use this word for the true God, but we'll remind the pagans that the true God is personal and the true God is only one God. There's only one true God. So that's what you call, missionaries call contextualization. You have to take the gospel and contextualize it to the culture in which you're in. So I think that's what Muhammad was doing there, and then continued to use the moon as a symbol of that God, but he was trying to move. And I think that's the... Had he just said, let's just worship the moon god, it'd be so much easier to convert Muslims today. Because I always ask my students when I teach world religions, you got all these people in the Middle East and Arab countries worshiping many gods. Muhammad shows up and gets them to worship only one God, which is so much closer to Christianity. Did Muhammad do us a favor? Because now their beliefs are so much closer to Christianity. No, what he did was he took a Monopoly $20 bill, which was so obviously fake, and now he made a counterfeit $20 bill that looks so much like the real thing that now these guys are convinced that they have the true God. And it's so much harder to... So a convinced... The success we're having leading Muslims to Christ is in countries where they're Muslims in name only, where the choice was either die or convert to Islam. Okay, well, then I'll say I'm a Muslim. Now leave me alone. And then they can't read Arabic, so they're not even encouraged to read the Quran. So they go through, 5-6 generations of claiming to be Muslims, and they don't even know what they're supposed to believe in. They could care less. And and then in real Middle Eastern countries where they really are Muslim, we're probably having more Muslims convert because of Jesus appearing to them in dreams than we are through missionary work and stuff. Now, usually when Jesus appears to them in a dream, they don't become Christians. They just become curious about Jesus. So the missionary is needed. The Bibles are needed to get them on right track, because it's usually a couple years after a vision or dream of Jesus before a Muslim actually converts.
And the Quran has good things to say about Jesus.
But yeah.
When they do read it, if they're open,
well, they're not the right Jesus. So that's the key. In the Quran,
Anish Shirosh, what he would do, he would witness from the Quran and say, look, okay, the Quran says Muhammad is a greater prophet than Isa, than Jesus. But let's look what the Quran says about Muhammad and what the Quran says about Jesus. Muhammad didn't perform miracles. Jesus did. Muhammad had to ask forgiveness, confess his sins. Jesus never sinned. And then look at the titles of Muhammad versus the titles of Jesus. So even though he's not the Son of God, he's not God, there's ways that you can get Muslims curious about Jesus. And then you could show Muhammad says that Allah cannot err and his truth cannot be perverted. And Muhammad says the Injil, the Gospels, are God. So basically, there's ways of taking the Quran and its contradictory teachings and showing them you ought to trust what the Gospels say about Jesus. And see, Muhammad himself never read the Gospels, so he thought the Gospels said what he was saying. But the Gospels didn't say what he was saying. They were refuting what he was saying. And so you can get Muslims all caught up in, wow, and now I'm excited about Jesus. I want to learn more about Jesus. And the authoritative place to go is the Gospels. Now, westernized Muslims have already been programmed to be biased against the Gospels. And so that's where we face a big problem there. Okay, with henotheism, there's many gods. One is supreme. Mormons say we're not polytheist. Because though we believe in many gods, we believe in one supreme God. No, that's henotheism is still a form of polytheism. They're not monotheist. They need to stop claiming to be. In fact, you can make a case. Mormons are either polytheist or they're atheist. Because you can actually make a scholarly case that Mormons are atheist because you only have, in Mormon thought, for intelligent beings, humans, angels, and gods. And the first God, Lorenzo Snow, Mormon living prophet, said, God, when man is now as God once was, God is as man may become. So even the first God, you have to have a man on a planet who progresses to godhood before you get your first God. In the Bible, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Wow, that explains everything. Mormonism, you got to have an unexplained planet and an unexplained man before you can get your first God. And but who are angels? Angels are humans who didn't progress to godhood. And so basically, in the end, all you have are humans who can progress to a stage that they call godhood, but they're only, you know, mega glorified humans. So you can make a case that Mormons are atheists. So it just depends how you look at it. Well, but since humans can become God, what's that?
Which definition of atheism, the new one or the original?
Well, the definition that really you just have humans. Because angels are just a higher stage of humans who progress to that point.
No God.
And then the gods are just a higher stage. Yeah. So it would be more in that. It's just they choose to, you know, you can just, if you get enough rewards and you progress enough, you get the status of, you become the head of your own planet. But is that really what we mean by God? So... but whatever the case, and this is why, again, Francis Schaeffer pointed out, Walter Martin pointed out it as well. This is why it's very, very important that we define our terms. Now, what we'll do is we'll take a break for about 5 minutes, and then we'll...